Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Dr. Emma Morton, and I would like to warmly welcome you all to our 25th Talk BD episode on mania. I am speaking to you today from snowy Vancouver in British Columbia, the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. So wherever you are joining us from today, I'd like to thank you for being with us. The Talk BD series is hosted by Crest BD, a collaborative research network where people with bipolar disorder, academics, and clinicians work hand in hand to advance knowledge and share that knowledge back with the community through events like this one. In today's session, we'll be talking about the experience of mania, which is part of the diagnostic definition of bipolar disorder, but it can be harder to find resources to support people experiencing an episode of this type as compared to an episode of depression. And while research does show that hypomania or manic symptoms are experienced less frequently compared to depressive symptoms, the state still has profound impacts on functioning, relationships, and sense of self. So today we're hoping to bring some clarity to this topic and share practical strategies. Today we're fortunate to have returning guest speakers from our Talk BD episode on psychosis. Their discussion was so engaging and so helpful, we just couldn't help but organize another session to have them back for another round of conversation. So I'd like to welcome back Dr. Manuel Sanchez de Carmona, a psychiatrist, researcher, and member of the International Society of Bipolar Disorders Board of Director. And we're also joined by Victoria Maxwell, an award-winning mental health speaker, Crest BD regular and performing, Talk BD regular and performing artist, and one of the original Crest BD members. So thank you for joining us today. Before we get started with some introductions, I wanted to quickly note a couple of important things related to today's topic. First off, a question that always comes up when we talk about mania is, how can I enjoy the good parts of hypomania, the creativity, the energy, and the social connection without the risk of mania? And our panelists are going to dig into this really important, challenging question today. But we'd like to note in advance that different people may have different experiences of hypomania and mania that range from distressing to inconvenient or even positive and enjoyable. And different people and their clinicians have different appetites for risk or different levels of experience managing this type of symptom. So I do want to note that the panelists today are speaking from their own lived experience or clinical experience. And considering that we are often joined by people who are newly diagnosed or still trying to find ways to manage their condition, our advice may err on the side of being conservative. But we do encourage people to have discussions with their own clinicians and support network if your decisions are different to what we talk about today. The second issue I'd like to acknowledge is that today's topic can bring up some very challenging memories for people who've experienced mania. So please do be gentle with yourself throughout today's webinar. If any uncomfortable thoughts or feelings are brought up, and if you are experiencing distress, please consider reaching out to one of the crisis supports linked to on our Talk BD page. So with that covered, let's move on to some introductions. I'm a researcher at the University of British Columbia working with the Crest BD team to build and evaluate our Polaris app, which is a self-management app to help people with bipolar disorder optimize their quality of life. Here at Crest BD, we try to practice what we preach about work-life balance. So I'll also be asking our panelists the usual question, what their hobbies are in addition to what they do for work. So personally, with the arrival of snow in Vancouver, I'm looking for cozy activities. I've just put in a big order of yarn and wool so I can work on some crochet projects over the winter season. I'll now pass the microphone to Dr. Manuel to introduce himself. Please tell us about what you do for work as well as one non-work thing you do in your downtime.
Thank you, and I'm delighted to be here. Happy to have prepared with me again and back to work. And I'm very happy to be back with all this beautiful audience. I am currently in sunny Mexico City. You're in snowy Vancouver and sunny Mexico City. I've been practicing private psychiatry for 26 years, working with bipolar disorder at the same time. As you said, I'm a professor of clinical psychiatry in the Anáhuac University here in Mexico City. And I work intensely in the ISBD, in the International Society for Bipolar Disorders. I have the honor to be a past president, And I'm working every day with Erin and all our friends in the society. Hobbies, I love art. I'm passionate about art. I like visual art. I practice a little bit of piano, but mainly my main hobbies is exercise, biking, and art.
Thank you, Victoria.
Oh, thanks, Emma. Hi, everyone, again. Really great to be here. If you've been here before, you know that I have been a part of CREST from its very beginning. I'm also a mental health speaker and performer, performing my one-person shows, and a blogger for Psychology Today. And I live with bipolar disorder, anxiety, and psychosis. And what I do on a personal level, well, right now I have picked up, similar to Emma, I bought my first real sewing machine and I'm going to start. I took a sewing class with a friend of mine and it's really fun. And so I'm endeavoring to make a few items potentially for Christmas gifts and then pajama pants. So that's, there you go.
Thank you, Victoria, Manuel. So such a pleasure to have you back. Given that you both have some creative pursuits, I'm sure you'll be interested in our next topic, but I'll talk more about that at the end of today. We also have behind the scenes helpers, Caden and Bryn, who will be talking in the chat. A little bit of housekeeping: people submitted questions before the webinar, and we'll also take questions through the Q&A box on Zoom during the event. But for now, we'll get to our main presentation and I'll hand things over to Manuel and Victoria.
Excellent. Thank you, Emma. I'm so happy to be back here. And I think that the topic of today is actually taking a lot of the things that we discussed in our prior webinar, but we're going to a milder level and actually it's more challenging. And I think I love the topic because I think important take-home message that I want all the audience to understand is that hypomania and mania develops gradually. And my idea, my principal goal today is to talk about those initial symptoms that actually can be so important and relevant for a good treatment and a great prognosis. So let's begin. Victoria, will you let me brief a little bit of the audience about the symptoms of mania?
Well, for me, and I'll speak just from my personal experience. So for me, and I think it's common for some people, is that my sleep starts to change. I usually have a lot of creative ideas, and it's the seductive part because it's starting to slowly happen where I actually have some good ideas and I'm getting a lot done and it's pretty good. And then sometimes it only stays at hypomania and goes back down, but then it can propel into higher states, which would be full-blown mania. And that's where I see a lot of the damage that's happened in my life. And including sort of financial decisions, risk-taking, sexual promiscuity, inappropriate social behavior, things like that. And those are the things that probably have been the most damaging, both to my identity, but also just practically in my life and losing friendships.
You know, I would like to go first with real major symptoms here so people can be familiar with symptomatology. And many of the audience know the DSM-5, the Manual of Diagnostic and Statistical Manual here in psychiatry, but I like more a list of criteria that you can download them very easily in online, which is, they are called the HCL questionnaire. And it's a list of 32 items that really go over all of the domains. If you have in a week, 7 of this, positive, we have to be careful. Something may be happening. If you have 14 of these, definitely we may be talking about hypomania or mania. What are the symptoms? The first one, and I love it, number one, there's a decrease of the need of sleep. This is very different from insomnia. You feel that you need less hours of sleep. If you regularly sleep for 8 hours, you need 7, 6, 5, or 4. So that's item number one. You feel more energy, more active, more self-confident. You enjoy your work more. You're more sociable. WhatsApp, messages, emails can actually show us when someone is cycling, the speed, the frequency, the early hour messages. You want to travel more, you want to drive faster, you spend, and in a very stupid way, you don't make any sense of what you're spending. You spend a lot on things that you don't really need. You take more risks in your daily life, more actively, physically, more projects, more creative, less shy, extravagant. You dress differently, your clothes, your makeup may be different. You want to meet more people, more interest in sex, more sexually active. You talk more, you think faster, you make jokes, you get easily distracted. Your thoughts jump from one topic to another one. You do things more quickly, you're more impatient. You can be irritating to all other people, and even you may find frustrating talking to other people. You get into more quarrels, your mood is higher, optimistic, and there's a lot of abuse of alcohol, cigarettes, of medications, coffee, all those things may go high. So these are 32 points that, as I said, when you begin to have them, there's a yellow light if you have 7, red light if you have 14. And here I want to say something. Mania and hypomania begins like droplets. You know, think of a big thunderstorm. You never get a big thunderstorm with lightning in 1 second. You begin to see the drops. So you may notice someone or yourself that you're okay in the morning and in the evening or otherwise, or interchangeably, you can begin with certain symptoms like droplets. And in a moment, those droplets get more water and more water. And that's when all the symptoms begin. So my goal here is to make you acknowledge that this begins gradually. And it's a challenge to know yourself. And I think that we have to do an exercise to go back to the last mania and actually think, how did it all start? Can you relate to this, Victoria, to the...
Yeah, I know, I totally can. And one thing, and I just noticed in one of the comments, I relate, is that I definitely see myself needing less sleep and some of the other symptoms, but I never really had a lot of irritability or sort of an argumentative. There was maybe a time where there might be one or two, but that, and I guess I'm speaking to that because it goes to what you're saying, is that you sort of look back and see what I call my fingerprint warning signs. So everybody has a different fingerprint. I think everybody has different warning signs for hypomania and mania. So my warning signs might be different than someone else's warning signs, and most likely they are. And I definitely can see that it starts slowly, which is, I think, sometimes the slippery slope, because it's not full blown where it's obvious that, oh, okay, this is what I'm experiencing. I'm sort of going, well, I've got more energy today. Well, maybe that's because I got more exercise yesterday or something. And so it seems there's a normalcy to it. But then when I see it build up to a certain level, that's when it starts to become not a certain level, but a certain intensity and a number of symptoms, like you said. And I've been lucky. I haven't had a lot of experiences with mania in the last little while, some hypomania, but I've been able to sort of intervene early enough to sort of just manage it so that it doesn't escalate. So, yeah.
So here's a very common question. What's the difference between hypomania and mania? And I think there's not a specific answer, but I think that the best answer that I can give is functionality. Hypomania, it's functional. However, people who know you well can tell that you're different, that your energy level is up. Someone who doesn't know you may be fooled, may say, oh, what a great energy this person has. But someone who really knows you and yourself, you know that you're not at your normal level of energy. Here's the tricky part. As you know, bipolar disorder 2 only experiences hypomania and a lot of depressive episodes. And bipolar 1 may begin with hypomania, but if this is not stopped or noticed, this may go higher and higher to full-blown mania or even psychosis. So that is why we have to take very seriously hypomanic symptoms. I think that I also want to say another concept before you continue, sorry. And I want to tell the audience there's something that we call mixed symptoms. Briefly, I just want to say that you may have symptoms from both poles. Number, the name of bipolar, I'm not crazy about the name of bipolar because people may get misled that either you have one pole or the other one, and you may have both, right? So both at the same time, manic symptoms and depressive symptoms. So you may begin having mixed symptoms as the first symptoms of a full-blown mixed episode. So that's another tricky part that I want the audience to remember.
Yeah, and I was just going to mention that one of the things that I do notice is that when I'm getting out of my routine and more motivated to get out of my routine and take more sort of not being as careful with it, that's often a sign when I'm starting to rev up a bit. And I think the hardest part for me has been, and early on, was reconciling that I needed to take seriously, like you said, about the hypomania, because I've got bipolar one, that it could lead into mania, and I have experienced psychosis. So it was, I worked with a psychiatrist and he was really good. He told me, he said, so let's really be on top of the hypomania, but be very careful that you're not exacerbating it because it feels good. So not sleeping less or staying, you know, sleeping, you know, 5 hours when I normally sleep eight. If you're still feeling good and functional and it's not escalating, then as long as we're keeping on top of it and you're taking your medication, that's okay. Because sometimes I think there's a fear of feeling too good. Like I know when I was first diagnosed and I started to feel better because I was being treated for the depression as well as the mania, I didn't know if I was going into a manic state or a hypomanic state. And so there was sort of like some caution to say, okay, I just can't do anything. And that just sort of defeated the whole purpose of the recovery path. So it was a real learning process about what were my limits and how do I respect them without limiting myself so that I felt like I was sort of becoming sort of reclusive almost.
And I would like to say before we talk about the solutions that there's a lot of situations, medications, and substances that can induce mania. I think that when someone is having the first symptoms, or maybe not even any symptom, we always have to be very careful with alcohol, stimulants, some kind of medication such as steroids, you know, certain kind of medications and substances, antidepressants can actually push someone to the limit. So we have to be very careful. And when you have some of the symptoms that I just shared, you have to be extra careful because mania can be prevented or stopped if you follow the advice that we're going to give you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you'd be reading my doctor's notes, Manuel.
Because every day.
yeah, because it's very, very true that I know that if I'm in any state of hypomania, I have to be super careful about having any alcohol, even cigarettes, caffeine. I don't usually have caffeine anyway. And then also knowing the stressful situations that I might be walking into, which I think is some of the things that you're going to address. And I think what was really, what I found very hopeful was that I could prevent myself from moving into a full-blown mania. So the things that sort of led me into the psychiatric ward into the diagnosis and really burning a lot of bridges in my life, I could actually prevent that from happening again. And that was really empowering. And it took a while to sort of, it was having experience under my belt. And that experience actually came from really, you know, not so great experiences, but being able to see, so what are the factors that that influenced sort of the onset, and then what were the things that maintained it and what were the things that exacerbated it. And so with that, I could sort of make a roadmap with my healthcare providers to sort of choose and look at what were the most effective things to eliminate and watch out for.
You know, I would like to make a special note on stress, because people think negative stress always, and positive stress, winning something, in your case, making a performance, doing a movie, having a new contract, you know, anything that makes you go up. You have to think of mania like a home run. You throw the ball all over the park, you know, over the park. So you have to think in stress in both ways, negative and positive. And mania is closely related to positive stress. So if you're having a good lock of positive stress, which I'm happy, you have to be careful. You have to be careful to take it one step at a time, try to keep it slow, enjoy your success, but remember that sometimes success can be so overwhelming that can push your mood in a way that you don't like it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've really had to reframe that, because then I felt like, oh God, then I, you know, what can I experience? And so it was actually through another webinar that we had around sleep. And the example was that some people have a body clock that's like a Timex. And so for those of you that are familiar with watches, the Timex old commercial says, you know, can take a licking and keeps on ticking. And so it's this really hardy thing, and it doesn't matter what you do to it, it'll all, you know, they had a picture of a person diving into a pool and it was fine. And then there's the Rolex, and the Rolex is delicate, it's not less valuable. It's actually more valuable. It's very beautiful. It's elegant, but you have to be a little bit more careful with how you handle it. And so I can sort of reframe it and say, oh, okay. So I'm like a Rolex, or a Swiss watch. Okay. So I just need to be a little careful about sort of what I do. I can't like dip it into the ocean or, you know, things like that. And so it doesn't mean that I can't have, you know, I can't go to a party with it. I can totally go to a party with it, but I just have to be careful about what I do at the party. And so,
I love your example. I have an Apple Watch. So yeah. Apple Watches needs to recharge.
Right. Yes. Watches. Oh, that's good.
That's good, right? So if you want more battery, you need to recharge if you want to continue. And this is so much true with people with BD, because you need to recharge every night. And okay, you may go to a party, you may party or whatever you want, but you need to pay the hours in the next day. You need to recharge. Recharge in bipolar disorder is so critical.
Yeah.
You always need to recharge. And I think that add that to your examples. You can be a Timex or Rolex or an Apple Watch.
I think that's great. And that's what I find is like when I do performances, I am very spent, but it's that kind of really good kind of tired. And so it's easy for me to just push and continue through. And I just have to really respect. And also, if I can have the luxury of creating my the rest of the day or the next day in a way that I can recharge, or I do things that are just a little easier than a normal traditional work day. So, yeah.
Okay. So now let's talk treatment before we go to the questions from the audience. And I think that the good news is there are a lot of anti-manic agents. And we have the CanMat ISBD guidelines, which are fabulous. Very few you can see the whole list. But let me briefly say, we have mood stabilizers. Lithium and valproate are excellent in dealing with mania. And some antipsychotics, atypical antipsychotics, which have great anti-manic features. Aripiprazole, ziprasidone, olanzapine, clozapine, cariprazine, there's a big list. And here the trick with these medications is that you need them to give them timely. You know, there's a moment, it's like when a surfer is looking for a wave, you know, if you hit the moment because before you go to the big wave, then medications work perfectly. And you may have someone stable, let's say with valproate and lithium, and think about the medications like if it was like a big net, like a mesh net. And the disorder is still alive. You're going to have the cycles, and medications like a net keep you all controlled. But as any net, there are spaces between the threads. And think about a fish that goes through the net. That's mania or hypomanic symptoms. So sometimes you need another, a small squeeze of an antipsychotic, aripiprazole, risperidone, to lower those fishy movements that you may have, you know? So I think that you have to think that medications work perfectly if you time them correctly. And some anti-manic agents only are given during the crisis. When the full episode is done, you return to your maintenance treatment. And there are certain medications that need to be taken away in mania. Antidepressants can actually impede anti-manic agents to work, and they can actually make your mania worse. So you have to take away all antidepressants, and some medications like cortisone, some steroids can actually push you to mania. So you have to be very careful with medications. And of course, alcohol and illegal substances, all those things should go away, absolutely. So it's treatable, and you have to act very fast because you need the patient to remain stable as soon as possible. Mania can get complicated because your mind is going so fast that you may say things, do things, and your life can be complicated if symptoms are not stopped. So the good news is that it's totally treatable. You can stop mania with the medications that we have. The challenge here is to give the medication on time.
Yeah, I mean, that's been my experience as well. And I sort of, for me, my medication combination is a little different, but I know the last mania that I went into particularly, I think it was an antipsychotic to help me sleep. And it allowed me to sort of do that recharge and almost a reset and be able to sort of get, and it was right at that acute time. And then I didn't need to continue taking the antipsychotic, but I continued to take my regular medication. Mm-hmm. And I have had the experience of an antidepressant when I wasn't on a mood stabilizer that popped me up into a mania. And that was not a very good experience.
Oh, no. And, you know, there's medications, for example, like quetiapine, that depending on the dose, if you go to higher doses, 600, that is an antimanic. And if you have it in 300, 450, that's perfect for maintenance or for the depressive symptoms. So some medications are moved depending on the episode that you are. So I think that we're ready for the audience, right?
Yeah, I just wanted to say one thing before is that when you were talking about sort of that net, which is a really great metaphor, is that some of the things when those symptoms come through can be managed then by lifestyle shifts. So it's like, choosing not to, like, I don't use recreational drugs. I make sure I exercise. I make sure that I have social contact, sort of the things that we've heard of before as the social or the self-management techniques. And so we have a lot of power in how our wellness journey occurs. So I just wanted to emphasize that sort of not all medicine.
Absolutely. Let me throw a little bit. For example, some people may think that exercising a lot can make you tired and then you're going to go to sleep and slow the manic symptoms. And it's totally the other way. Doing more activity is pushing you up. So you have to remain very under the radar, you know, like avoid exercise, try not to go to a concert, try to keep it slow, keep it cool, you know. Those are things, and I think that when your significant other is having any kind of the symptoms, and you have to help them, and you actually have to help them. And I remember we did a conference last year in ISBD that a psychologist that has BD, he shared with us that he had two cell phones, and the moment he had his cell phone for mania, there were no bank accounts, there were no social media. It was just communication to the important people. And every time that he felt that he was beginning to have symptoms, he changed from his safe cell phone, you know, because he told us that if he was manic and he had any of those online shopping apps, those things can be very, very tricky. I think that the cell phone can actually be a lot of harm for someone who has high energy. So those are the many tricks and advice that I like to give the audience that can actually help you. And I think that finances is another topic that is fascinating in mania, because we have to be very careful with your own finances.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Manuel and Victoria, for that really interesting presentation. It was beautifully illustrated with metaphor. I can really see the creative sides of both of you coming out there and in just how you described some of those experiences. And I think what is really coming through for me is this element of getting to know yourself and your support networks, so you can work together to figure out what's needed based on your own individual pattern, getting to know your own kind of weather system, to lean into Manuel's analogy about the droplets and the thunderstorms. So you know, when can I go out with, you know, and risk not taking an umbrella? When might I need to have my bus pass on me because it's going to be way too wet to get home? When do I have to call a ride? You know, that kind of analogy works very well for me, given I'm in rainy Vancouver and have to make those kinds of plans all the time. And obviously, it's difficult for us to get into all of the individual variation on the kinds of strategies that you can apply. We will be talking at the end about some resources that, you know, we have so many talk meetings to date on finances and sleep, things like that, that we can hopefully refer people to. But I know that a lot of the topics that you will all be interested to hear will be coming up in our question and answer section. So I will, without further ado, get to that right away. So our first question for the speakers: for people with bipolar disorder, is there any downside to being mildly hypomanic? I'm always afraid to be completely honest when I feel slightly hypomanic because my doctor tends to overreact. I have experienced mild hypomania so many times that it does not escalate to full mania. I feel as though I'm not allowed to feel good or creative because I have bipolar disorder. If a person without bipolar says that they are having a couple of weeks of feeling really good, no one would blink an eye.
First of all, I can completely relate to that. And I'll let Manuel talk about the sort of the risks about, you know, being able to maintain that mild hypomania. Because I mean, for myself, I don't experience sort of the length that you were talking about, the 2 weeks. I may have a day, but it seems to right itself. And I don't know if that's something about because I'm able to sort of just, if I become good at managing the illness or something. So I am still able sort of to enjoy the mild hypomania, but that's partially because I see it doesn't last longer than a few hours or a day or something. So Manuel, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh my God, you're making me suffer because that's my daily life here. And I'm so into my patient and with a patient that I suffer because I do enjoy seeing them happy and seeing them, especially when someone has been in long depressive episodes. I'm so happy to see them full of joy, and I'm actually enjoying the mania and the hypomanic symptoms. But I'm always worried, you know. I'm like, oh my God, but be very careful and try to sleep and try to. So I do a lot of psychoeducation. I get in touch with them very, very closely. You know, like, these are the rules. Okay, you may do this, but you may not do this. And we try to go back to the past and see what were the mistakes done before. Certain people can actually be toxic. Certain activities can be toxic. So we have to see who are the positive relationships, who are the positive activities that need to be done. And I also like my patient to have like their rescue kit. That's how I call it. You know, like, okay, you may go to the race, you may do this, but you're going to bring this safe medication for you. And it's like, you're going to promise me if this happens, if you're not sleeping this much, you are going to do this. You can call me and you have your medication, your anti-manic medication with you. So that's what I do. I have to agree that is the question that I most commonly have when I'm talking about this topic. Doctor, is there any medication that can have me in permanent hypomanic state?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah. Not. We don't have that yet.
No. And I really appreciate you saying about sort of the activities that you know are triggering and not, because there's some activities that I can do while I'm in a hypomanic state that are fine and they don't trigger me. One of the things that I wanted to also say about sort of stressors is that with meditation, it almost seems counterintuitive that you'd think, well, meditation would calm you down and all this kind of stuff. But when I meditate, it's very easy if I'm hypomanic or manic to get into an altered state and to get that expandedness. So I sort of consider it curating what my activities are on the day that I'm feeling that way. So it doesn't mean that I can't go back to meditating, but it means that maybe I can do the creative things that I feel I'm most sort of in flow with, that I know still allow me to experience the enjoyable parts without risking going into sort of sliding down into, or sliding up really into the hypomanic elements.
Thank you both for your answers to that question. It sounds like it's really important to have both a trusting relationship with your healthcare provider where you can have that collaborative decision making. And also the optimistic message coming through what Victoria is saying is that each time if that hypomania goes a little too far, you learn something more about what's the trigger, what's helpful, and that early planning gets better and better with time and experience. I have a question related to the medication issue that you brought up earlier, Manuel. Every one of my manic episodes I've experienced in my life has been triggered after being medicated during an episode of depression. If all my manic episodes are medication induced and never occur organically, am I really bipolar at all?
I think that, let me see if I get the question. This person is asking that despite the medication, he or she is always cycling, right?
It seems to be that they're saying, like, with antidepressant medication or after being medicated for an episode of depression, which we might assume to have antidepressant medications, there being a switch to mania. So I guess the question under there is that switch always triggered by medication? Are there other explanations for that? And what does that mean about the diagnosis of bipolar disorder?
Well, first of all, I don't think that this questions the diagnosis of bipolar. Totally on the contrary. This is a typical case of bipolar illness, you know, because that fragility, that vulnerability to medication actually speaks about the illness. I think that I will advise this person to go back to the medication history and make this list of the medications that are related to this cycling. Definitely, antidepressants is a common practice in psychiatry. However, with bipolar, there are certain rules. Some experts recommend only giving 50% of the regular dose, you know, only 50%. And the moment that the symptoms begin to improve, that medication has to be stopped. Absolutely. Venlafaxine, for example, SSRI, NSSRI medication is typical to push to mania if it's not given properly. You know, tricyclics, many kind of antidepressants. So you have to be careful on that. So my advice is use antidepressants in a very careful and guided way. Medications are not 100% proof that you're not going to cycle. So when someone is cycling despite medications, maybe the combination is not correct. So we have to go back and see what were we combining. Because for example, I just saw one this morning, someone who is in lurasidone and quetiapine, and she's bipolar one with a lot of manic episodes. So she needs something more for the manic symptoms, not so much things for the depressive side. Medications can be divided depending on how effective are they for controlling mania or depressive episodes. That is called predominance. So you have to make your own medication combination depending on your cycles. So even though you may have the same illness, even the same type of the illness, the polarity, that is the predominance of the episodes, may be different. And that is key for deciding which medication is good for you.
Well said. I don't have anything else to say because all I can say is I went through that process with my psychiatrist, is finding that, like, tweaking and tweaking, and it took quite a while. So for those of you who are newly diagnosed and, you know, are still trying to find medication that works, don't give up, and know that if it's taking a long time, that's okay. It normally quite often take a long time. So it's not.
But you know what I like is, like, you just said the key word, it's a process. So be patient, and you have to make a good team with your doctor, because I was just watching the chat and there's something very common that I know that some people are so afraid of sharing that they're feeling well, because they say, oh, they're gonna say I'm manic. Oh, they're gonna stop, you know? So you have to have a trustful, honest relationship with your caregiver. And in order to have success with the medications, you have to understand it's a process and you have to be open, ask everything you need and be very clear about pros and cons and choose together the medications. It is an active process in which the patient is so important because at the end of the day, they are the one who's taking the medication. So the doctor has to be patient. And I always, when I talk with my colleagues, I want to remember them. The patient goes first. And you have to listen to them. And you have to be in their own shoes. You know, like you have to understand what actually is this very simple thing, taking your medication every day. That is something so difficult to accept. And I think that that is a key point here. When the diagnosis is made for the first time, okay, there's a lot to digest that I have this illness. And the point two is that I need medication. And that may seem very simple, but you know that it takes a lot of time, sweat and tears to understand that you need the medication. And you have to be patient, and it's a whole process. And it's very common. And you know, I like to say this to my patients, you have to love your medication. You have to kiss your meds, you know, because you have to love them because they're allies. They're not your enemies. If you think that medication is your enemy, you're not gonna get through. You need to love your medication.
Yeah, yeah. I like to even call it medicine as opposed, because medication sometimes has such a pejorative connotation with it. And so medicine sometimes, you know, I can feel like, right, my medicine, I'm taking my Robitussin and I'm taking my Epival and all that kind of stuff. So
remedies or whatever you want to call them, you know, your solutions.
Thank you. The process of finding the right medication is obviously very complicated. And for many people, unfortunately, does have those periods of trial and error. We'll definitely link people to our earlier talk, BD, on medication, which has a lot of really useful strategies on how to find somebody and how to build that collaborative relationship if that's a goal that you'd like to work with your psychiatrist.
Yeah, because I did want to say that being honest can be really frightening, and I can really relate to that because it sometimes doesn't feel safe. But being able to have an advocate with you while you are talking to your healthcare provider so that you can have an open conversation and be as honest. And if you disagree with them, still being able to have that discussion instead of feeling like you have to sort of shut down and hide, because I know that's caused me problems in the past.
Thank you. I think that leads into another question. So I'll choose this one. It's kind of got two parts. One which is about the kind of course of mania, but the other one I think taps into what you've just been talking there about, Victoria, in terms of the support network. So this question is actually from someone in that support network. In your experience, does someone's previous manic episode predict how long a subsequent episode will last? Spouse here in a very, very difficult situation with my husband, will not return to get treatment for his bipolar disorder and is in a really unfortunate situation. His last episode was 4 years ago and was 8 months long.
8 months long? No, yep. Medications.
Mm-hmm. Will not return to get treatment currently. So I think this episode is about the outlook for predicting future episodes. But I think we've also got here a person, you know, caring for the carer situation might need some advice.
Well, I think it's a very difficult question because every person is different and you cannot say this like a rule of thumb, but I can tell that a number of episodes actually relate sadly to prognosis and to complications. So untreated mania can actually deal with deterioration, with complications in the future. So definitely mania should be always shortened. You know, it's an emergency. I say that 6 months, 4, 8 months is the classic illness if you don't treat the person at all. And it is a very long and strong episode that may have like ups and downs, but if it's not treated, you see that there's a big scope of symptoms. And those are moments in which things can go really bad. So the goal here is to be treating the episode on time. So the question, if you can say if he had in the past long episodes, is going to continue to have them? Yes, sadly, yes. Second, are they going to be exactly the same? Sadly, no, they may even be worse, because if they're not treated, they may get mixed symptoms and get more complications. The brain actually damages if you have untreated mania, because just think about it, Emma, the stress of being like this for many months, the amount of energy, all your metabolism, all your body is to the limit. So definitely that is a struggle, and that hurts your whole health. So this is why this topic is so relevant, because we need to shorten the episodes and make them as brief as possible.
Thank you. Thank you for that answer, Manuel. Victoria, did you have anything to add to that question, whether it's about the variation episode types or how to communicate with somebody about their treatment, especially around this really sensitive topic of mania?
Yeah, I really feel for you, and I'm sorry that you're in that position. It's really hard to watch someone who's in distress or feels like they're not in distress, but you know they are. I think the best suggestion I could have is that, like Manuel was saying, is that within that period when that person gets unwell, there will be periods when that person will be more well. And to me, that's the time to speak to the person. And I know you probably already have, but being able to just explore the reasons why they don't want to have treatment. That was something that was really important to me, instead of someone pointing out saying, well, this is happening, you're not doing well at this, you need to go. Exploring with me to see what the reasons were behind it. I don't know what those reasons are, but sometimes that's helpful, because then it gives you insight, and it might be a misunderstanding, or it might be something where you can offer some support in a different way that allows the person to sort of see what's going on a little bit differently. So that's about the sort of the thing that comes to mind right away.
Can I ask Victoria something? Victoria, what would be your advice as a person who had been doing all this and suffering all the disorder? How do you convince someone to take the medication and they're so afraid to do it because they're afraid that the anti-manic medicine is going to put them back into depression? What would be your best argument to convince them?
Well, part of it is that it's not an argument and it's not about convincing. It's really about exploring.
Excellent point. Excellent point.
You know, it's about exploring and really listening. And also being able to say, well, could we do this as a research project, do some field research? So take this medication that I think might be helpful. If you start to feel like you're rolling back, then why don't we revisit it? So this idea that there's sort of, it's a dynamic process and it's not a forever thing. And I really believe that if I feel like I have a partnership, which is sometimes unfortunately rare with healthcare providers, but not always, I've found some really good ones. That's when the most effective kinds of treatment can be, because then I'm making the decision. I'm starting to be proactive in it. And then I also feel like the person that's on the other side of the desk is actually on my side. I think that would be, and then also for me to say, okay, what are the signs if your creativity is starting to wane and you think it's to do with the medication? Let's take a look at that. Like, what are the most important things that you don't want to have affected or that are the deal breakers? And being able to really honor that. Because I think that's one of the things, is that sometimes when it's a carte blanche, or it's a sort of an edict that someone gives, it doesn't work, unless maybe you're a toddler, and this wouldn't be bipolar disorder, it would be a timeout because you know, you just were needing to have a timeout.
I would like to add that as a caregiver, as a doctor, we have to be patient, and we have to understand that sometimes you will, the person with the manic symptoms will not take the medication the first time. And you have to understand that, that you have to be very patient, choose the correct words, choose the timing, and find the moment to do it. So if I go back to this 26 years of career, I can tell you so many fascinating, complicated stories that I've been through to convince someone to take the medication, to actually give the step. And my best advice is to be patient, that you have to give a hand to the person who's suffering and to the family, and to understand that it's a process, and it's a learning process. And when the person in need understands that you're teaching something and you're sharing these ideas and you're making, giving them advice to feel better, things begin to move. But you, if you impose a medication, if you force a medication, if you punish with a medication, things are never gonna work. And as a doctor, I can tell you that it's more clever to refrain, to restrain, to stop sometimes, to be, you know, like, okay, maybe I'm not gonna win this time with the medication, but I want to engage with the patient, gain some confidence, and begin slowly, gradually, step by step. And I want to say this to the doctors and to the caregivers, be patient, please.
Yeah, yeah, and it's never one conversation. And one of the things that did it ironically or counterintuitively help me was that it was a number of episodes that really started to frighten me, that I felt like I needed more help than I was able to give myself with the things that I was doing. And so to some degree, I said, all right, I'll try medication and see if this will work. And I had a lot of judgments about medication. I had a lot of judgments about accepting the diagnosis. It had to do with shame. It had to do with feeling like I wasn't being listened to, that my personality was being pathologized. So these were discussions that I really needed to have. And having that good rapport was really essential to me being willing to explore different choices than I would normally have made.
Thank you both for your thoughts on that one, both in terms of what the research tells us about what might happen in terms of the course of bipolar disorder, but this really sensitive discussion about how to have these collaborative discussions, whether you're a caregiver or a healthcare provider, that, you know, respect the other person's autonomy and individuality in making some of these decisions. Because it is a complicated process, as you both pointed out. On the topic of, you know, we talked a bit about medication and the role of the caregiver, but, you know, we do like to emphasize the things that a person can do for themselves. And this question, I think, kind of touches on that topic. The hardest part about recognizing my own manic symptoms is that you lose insight when you are feeling good. It's easy for depression, but when you're feeling manic, you don't want it to be part of an illness, and you don't want to listen to others when you are manic. Do you have tips on improving insight when manic?
That's a very good question. I think that psychoeducation is the key, and the key is to psychoeducate before being manic, you know? And the tricky part here is that when someone feels on the top of the world, when someone feels with a lot of energy, it's so difficult for them to understand that that is a symptom. And you get answers like, you're jealous, you're making me feel this way because you don't have the power that I have, and so back and forth. So I think that you have to focus on other things. Maybe irritability, maybe discussions, maybe financial problems that are already happening. You know, like, instead of getting your attention of certain symptoms, you have to begin to look in consequences. And consequences may actually help you for the person to acknowledge the manic phase.
Yeah, and I found that it was actually through experiencing manias that I had more insight. partially because I just had more experience under my belt, and I started to see, like I would, you know, go back and sort of do a, I can't remember what you call it, but sort of dissect what happened and what led up to it. And that's when I could get like a list of what I called those fingerprint warning signs. And so that was helpful to have sort of these things to look out for. And the other thing was to be very honest with myself from the very beginning. My dad told me, you know, it's more important that you're honest with yourself any more than you are with anyone else. It's important to be honest with other people, but I had to be honest with myself. And I think that gives you a fair fight in terms of insight, because when I started to lose insight, I was already at a loss. But if I could be on a daily basis when I was quite well, and I knew what warning signs I had to look out for, then if I saw one or two, then I could actually call and reach out to a friend who was non-judgmental or a healthcare provider and say, this is what I think is happening. Let me know if it seems to be getting worse. I think it might be mania or hypomania, and then call my psychiatrist and talk about what I might need to do. So.
Thank you both for your responses to that question. You know, here at Crest, we put a really big emphasis on empowerment and self-management and what people can do. So it was really great to have that discussed as well. I'm aware we're running close to the end of time, and there's so much to this topic and probably many more questions beyond the scope of what we can cover today. So I guess what I'd like to ask of you two as we draw to a close is, if you were speaking to somebody newly diagnosed with bipolar disorder and they're feeling really overwhelmed by this discussion of the course of mania and the impacts and the management, what's the one take-home message that you'd like them to have about dealing with hypomania and mania?
Don't be afraid. I think it's a learning experience, and that symptoms can actually be managed correctly. And you're not alone. You have a whole team of people working with you. And there are a lot of resources that I know that you are going to post them. And I think that as many things in life, discipline, dedication are key. And many complications can actually be prevented. And I think that living with this condition can actually give a different significance to your life in a way that you're going to learn a lot about your brain, and you're going to know how to deal with it. I think that you have to see all the treatment like a learning experience, like a whole course, you know, and I think that is key, to see this like a whole process in which you learn every day. And I just want to tell the audience that in the ISBD, there's a lot of people working hard to make medications better, to make solutions better. There's a whole group of people in the world focused on getting better treatment for mania.
Thank you, Manuel. Victoria?
Yeah, there's a lot of, that I'd like to say, but the first two things that come to mind is baby steps. You don't have to understand all of it all at once. It's okay. And I really like what you said, Manuel. You've got a team behind you. And if you don't help create one, sort of find those social supports and even one really good health provider, and really be kind to yourself. We're always doing the best we can. And if we had more information, we would have done differently in the past. I don't know if that actually made sense, is that the decisions that we made in the past were based on the information that we had. And so you'll continuing to learn, and you'll be able to make more insightful questions or more insightful decisions. And also just to look for examples of people that have bipolar disorder that are living really fulfilling lives, that have been able to go after the careers that they want, that have the family that they want, because I think hope is a really important part of the treatment process. And that allowed me to keep moving forward, and support groups were really important.
Sorry, I'm just going to jump in so that we can get to the resources.
Yeah, for sure.
We've got some good examples of where people can find those hopeful examples. Thank you both for those optimistic messages at the end. Our resources for today are stored on our talkbd.live website, where you can find out more information about the symptoms of mania and hypomania, as well as mood management strategies. We have also a blog, as Victoria was mentioning, looking for examples of people who have gotten through this. We have a blog from Crest BD member Louise Dwerryhouse on her own experiences of mania. She's a very compelling writer, and I highly recommend giving her blog a read. We have an exciting update with our TalkBD website. All of our previous episodes are now stored online. You can search by topic, by speaker, and if you're curious about learning more strategies about how to manage specific aspects of mania, I definitely recommend looking at topics on finances. Bipolar 101 and 102 have some good strategies on self-monitoring your mood. So please do explore further on our website. You can also listen to our previous TalkBD episodes on Spotify or your preferred podcast system, or watch them on YouTube. Our next TalkBD will be on creativity with Dr. Sherry Johnson, and that will be on December 12th at 5 p.m. Pacific time. So please do join us for that extremely interesting and highly requested topic. After you exit the Zoom today, a link will come up to sign up for the next TalkBD, as well as a survey about today's talk. And it's really helpful if you can give us feedback about what you'd like to hear about more in future. Please do consider signing up for our CrestBD newsletter, where you can hear about research studies as well as events like this one. And we'd like to thank, of course, our funders and partners who contribute to bringing events like this one to you. So once again, thank you to Victoria Manuel for joining us today. And until our next episode, please stay safe and well.
Bye. Thanks, Emma. Bye, everyone. Bye, Manuel. Thank you.
Bye. Take care.